We are on today for argument in case number 83833, consolidated with 84257, Lucky Lucy versus LGS Casino. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Mr. McNutt, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. 2 minutes, please.
Okay. So just so everyone's clear, there are 15 minutes per side. Because you've elected to reserve 2 minutes, when you get down to 2 minutes, the yellow light will come on and there'll be a tone, but the clock will keep running, and if you run out of time, you'll get the red light. And for Mr. Wright, on the respondent side, the clock obviously starts at 15 and runs down. You'll get a yellow light when it gets down to 5 and the tone, just to remind you of where you are on your time, and we'll continue on until the time is expired or we're done. Hope everyone understands how that works. I hate when people end up being confused in the middle of an argument. All right.
Well, I'm colorblind and hard of hearing, but I'll watch the time.
Sounds like a plan. Glad everyone can see the clock. And with that, you can go ahead and begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, Justice Pickering, Justice Kadis, Justice Bell, Dan McNutt, my colleague Matt Wolf, on behalf of appellate Lucky Lucy. It's said in a former career, in a former life, that no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. And after the last 3 years, I think most transactional lawyers probably think that no contract can survive a global pandemic. But this one did. And this one has all of the elements necessary for this court to reverse the district court's decision. And on a de novo review, this court can look at the text of the purchase and sale agreement. And when faithfully interpreting all of the provisions in the purchase and sale agreement, we'll come to that conclusion. The specific question before the court on appeal is whether seller violated the ordinary course covenant by virtue of complying with the governor's closure directive. So stated differently, the breach alleged against my client was compliance with Nevada law. Now that is a non sequitur. The district court erred when it misapplied or misinterpreted the terms of the purchase and sale agreement and misapplied the principles espoused in two Delaware Court of Chancery cases, Acorn and AB Stable. And while I do not disagree with the principles espoused in those cases by the vice chancellors in those cases and on those facts and under that record, I do disagree with how those principles were applied to the facts of this case, which are markedly different. The text and purchase of the purchase and sale agreement is important, and section 2.2i is the ordinary course covenant. And it says that seller will conduct the business in a manner generally consistent with past practices. And generally is a key modifier word that we'll come back to throughout as we analyze what the district court said, as well as what the vice chancellor said in the Acorn case. But the ordinary course covenant, like no covenant in a single covenant in a contract, it cannot be read in isolation. Rather, it must be read in harmony with all of the other sections of the purchase and sale agreement. And specifically, I would like to address two. 1.5C is the requirement, and both parties required this in the contract, that the seller would remain in compliance with all gaming regulations and Nevada law. And that, of course, includes the governor's closure directive. I would also direct the court to section 1.5E, which is a material adverse change clause, which says that that no material adverse change within seller's control related to gaming revenues. And there is a risk of loss shifting there. So in effect, there can be no material adverse change that's within seller's control related to gaming revenues, or that would be a breach. So for example, if the seller shut down all marketing as soon as the purchase and sale agreement was signed, that would be something that would probably materially affect gaming revenues that would certainly be within seller's control. But here, the only issue is compliance with the binding Nevada law, the governor's directive in March of 2020. When interpreting Section 2.2i, the district court did not give effect to both of those sections. In fact, the district court erroneously concluded, as conclusion of law number 5, that, quote, there's no provision in the agreement that acts or otherwise constitutes a material adverse change. That's at Appendix 325. And if, when looking, I simply cannot square that with Section 1.5e, which starts, no material adverse change within seller's control.
Mr.
And that will address
McNutt?
The risk of loss.
Sorry,
yes, Your Honor.
There's a little bit of a delay on the remote presentation, but my question is, the court in the AB Stable case out of Delaware discussed, I guess, the differences, the different goals and different application of a material adverse change clause as opposed to an ordinary course covenant, specifically that the material adverse change clause relates specifically to the financial condition of
Justice Kadish, we lost you.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, but I lost maybe 30 seconds.
Happen again?
Yeah.
With regard to the material adverse change, that relates specifically to the financial condition as opposed to the ordinary course covenant, which relates to continuing to operate the business ordinarily. So,
Justice Kadish, your voice is cutting out and going silent, so we're not hearing the questions.
Okay. Let me cut to the chase. Can you given differences between the material adverse change clause and ordinary course covenant, can you address those and why you think the ordinary course covenant has to similarly be construed like the material adverse change clause?
Yes, Your Honor. So I agree. What I understood from the question is, yes, I agree. The material adverse change clause does go to the overall value of the company. That's the AB Stable case, and they talk about that in both that and every other case on material adverse change. Whereas the ordinary course covenant is designed essentially to ensure that the buyer gets the same company, same business he contracted for at closing as he thought he was buying when he signed the purchase and sale agreement. And but under my initial discussion was about reading every aspect of the contract and giving it its full effect. So I do believe that in this case, obviously the district court was focused on 2.2i, which is the ordinary course covenant. And there's still a materiality qualification under an ordinary course covenant when you have the language like we do that says that seller is only obligated to run the business generally in accordance with past practices. And under the AB Stable case, they gave the chancellor, he came out and said there's two essential ways to look at this based upon the terms of the clause, whether we look at solely or exclusively at how seller ran the business in the prior history, or whether we look at the way comparable companies did. Now, AB Stable is a COVID case. It's 2020, so there's a lot of analysis of how other companies do things, and I think that's appropriate. But under either standard, Lucky Lucy operated in accordance with the law. If they were deposed, and we have a pretty short record, and my clients were not deposed in the case, but if they had been deposed, they, of course, would have testified that it's their ordinary course, historical practice, to comply with all Nevada law and all gaming regulations, especially under 1.5C. They could not have kept the hotel casino open when the governor's directive came down in March of 2020. So it cannot be a gotcha. It can't be you've complied with the law, therefore you're in breach of the contract. That sort of catch-22, if you will, is simply inappropriate. And it's unnecessary because when you factor in what 1.5C and E say, it allows the court to read the full contract in consonance that shows that the risk of loss related to anything related to gaming revenues. And that's the only thing at issue here. That's the only thing they were concerned about was, are the gaming revenues going to be the same? Is this a material change in the financial condition to the business? And that's why they called the termination. But in the record at 182, we have all of the financials from 6 months prior to COVID, as well as 6 months after the reopening, or I should say 6 months prior to the closure and 6 months after the closure. What those financials show, and again, Appendix 182, is that roughly the gross revenue in the 6 months prior was about $2.7 million. And then roughly in the 6 months after the reopening was $3.04 million. That's an 11% increase. So the analysis is, well, did a six-week temporary closure of the casino, did a six-week temporary layoff of employees, did that have a material effect on either the value of the business under the material adverse change clause? And the answer is resoundingly no, of course, because the business was better at what the closing date would have been in June of 2020 than it was if when he purchased it or signed the purchase and sale agreement in June or April of 2019. So that's how I would address your question with respect to the material adverse change clause. And as far as the ordinary course covenant, of course, every gaming licensee in this state would testify one after the other that it's our historical business practices to follow the law. And so
how do you address their argument that Lucky Lucy did more than was required by the governor's directives in terms of closure?
So I would address it in two ways, Your Honor. One, under AB Stable, they looked at whether or not the changes that were made were, I would call them drastic, and whether they were made in response to a governmental shutdown order or not. So here, all of the changes that were made, and there were only two, right? There was a temporary closure for 6 weeks from March 20 of 2020 to June 4th of 2020. And then there was a reopening. So it's about a 6 week window. And there were temporary layoffs while retaining all key staff in place so that they could, in the words of Mr. Kane in the email in the appendix, is that we could ramp back up quickly, which is exactly what they did. And their gaming revenues reflected that. Now in the AB Stable case, which is a case for specific performance, where seller was selling 15 hotels. And the key facts there are this. The hotels were closed before any governmental order came into place. In fact, the Jackson Hole, the Four Seasons at Jackson Hole was closed before, even though Teton County allowed hotels to remain open. The Palo Alto Hotel that was closed for, quote, the reason was by the CEO, quote, because there was no demand, not because there was a governmental order. And the timeline stacked up. They just shut down the hotels, laid off everybody. But there were even more key issues in AB Stable, which go to the materiality. One of those was their layoffs impacted labor employment unions and negotiating rights. But even more, we all know five-star or five-diamond hotels, holding that four and five diamond insignia is a big deal in their marketing. Well, they jeopardized that status by the other changes they made with their on-hand logistics, which they had decimated, as well as their marketing strategy. So taken as a whole, the drastic changes that were made in AB Stable were twofold. One, they were far more material than anything that was done here. And two, they were not in compliance with any governmental regulation at the time. They were strictly cost-cutting measures and said, we're going to ground regardless of what the government does. Here, Lucky Lucy was operating up until the day that the governor said, you can't operate anymore, 11:59 on the 19th or the 20th of March in 2020. So AB Stable, again, that's why I say I don't disregard the analysis of the Delaware Court of Chancery and the principles they apply, but when you bring them and put them on the facts and the record here, they just don't square, because Lucky Lucy did everything in response to the governor. And of course, this court and no other court is ever going to issue an opinion that says it's okay for you to violate the law as long if that means you don't violate another contract provision, right? That is simply not a reasonable outcome or a reasonable interpretation of this contract. And under the whole terms of the contract, you don't have to do that. In fact, what's ironic in the case and in the record is that under Section 1.11 of the purchase and sale agreement, Beyer had an obligation to get his gaming license. And Beyer had a long window to get his gaming license. And there were no conditions on that. He had to get his gaming license before close. If he didn't have his gaming license before close, he could buy four $20,000 a month extensions, but that never became an issue. But he said, and this is in the appendix in the motion for summary judgment, I think around 274, the transcript, he said, you know, they couldn't get their gaming license because of the governor's closure directive, which stopped the flow of gaming applications. So this is literally a case of heads I win and tails you lose. I'm excused from performance of my gaming license, but I'm going to be hyper-technical and looking at you and saying, you were supposed to comply with Nevada law under 15C, but you were supposed to operate your business in the ordinary course as if the governor's closure directive and COVID didn't exist. Again, those two things don't square. But this court can, on a de novo review, square them. Reading the purchase and sale agreement as a whole, we don't have to pick or choose and say, well, you're excused over here for not getting your gaming license, but you are held to strict liability over here, seller, by not perfectly operating your company as you have in the past because of a unforeseen, unknowable global pandemic. And even if the pandemic was potentially foreseeable because we had Spanish flu every 100 years and things of that nature, the governor's closure directive certainly was not. That's never happened before, at least as far as my historical research has shown. So that's the big key issue there, is that everything that the seller did was in response to the governor's closure. It obviously had no impact on the financials.
Okay. So I don't know if you can hear me, but Mr. McNutt, you've used your entire 15 minutes. But I will give you an extra, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll give an extra 2 minutes to the other side because of the difficulty we're having with the technology at the moment. But, so you'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Sure. Okay. So can we put 17 minutes on the clock? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, and please the court. My name is John Wright, represent the respondents. I want to address what the main argument seems to be centering around, which is the language of the ordinary course clause, which is unconditional, unwavering, and without exception. The appellant's argument seems to be that there's a conflict in the contract, and somehow that 15E absolves them of liability for breaching the contract by not maintaining the property in the ordinary course. There's a complete difference between the two clauses. The ordinary course clause talks about how the company is operated and that you must maintain the operation in the same way that you were at the time of signing, all the way through and including closing. That's how the business is operated, versus the other clause talks about changes in the financial condition. Operation doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the financial condition. It might, but it's not necessary. They are not modifiers of one another. And in fact, I wouldn't even call this, I know that they've been calling it a material adverse changes clause, but it's not a typical material adverse changes clause. Those would be exculpatory.
So, Mr. Wright, sure. Can you give an example of how you would have a material adverse change without any impact to the business operations?
Well, you could change the hours, and it may not have any resultant change. We don't know, because until you actually make the change, you don't know what the result is going to be. But in terms of the operations, you can't deny that having the doors open and having the doors closed is about as big a change as you can possibly conceive of in an ordinary course provision. But how would it not affect the financials? Well, it could, like you said, they opened the doors and they're saying that they actually made more money. So maybe a change in operation here, at least if you're talking about the time frame before the change was made versus after it reopened, maybe there isn't a financial difference between the two. But think about this. They let go all of the workforce. Letting go all the workforce is actually going to change your revenue because you don't have that huge payroll. So it's not an adverse financial decision, right? But it's actually one that they did probably try to preserve the financial assets, but it is a complete change in the operation to not have, you know, the majority of your workforce there. So that would be one example.
Mr. Wright, I'm hoping you can hear me. Your client has argued that it's excused from getting the gaming licensing because of the pandemic, which made it impracticable to do so. Wouldn't the same apply to their duty to keep it open and excuse, prevent it from being a breach?
Well, the difference is, number one, there's an antecedent breach. The appellant breached first by closing down the operation. That was in March. The requirement to get the gaming license isn't a hard requirement until the day of closing, which is sometime in June. So that's the first issue because, well, they breached first. They have an unmitigated obligation to conduct themselves the way they did at the time the contract was signed.
Even if the governor orders them not to.
Sorry, go ahead.
Even if the governor orders them not to. It's still a breach to close down when the governor orders you to close down.
It is, because the difference here is, and it's like the AB Stable case talks specifically about that. They said, look, this is not a situation where the court is being asked to order the doors to be opened in contravention of the law. That they would not be able to do. That my client could not do to the seller. However, when you have an ordinary course provision that is not tempered by material adverse effects clause, which gives them a specific out for this, then they're the ones who accepted that risk that something could happen. Laws change. It doesn't have to be foreseeable. The point of the ordinary course provision is that it's taking into account any eventuality, not necessarily ones that are foreseeable to the parties at the time that they're entering into it. That's, if you wanted that, you could have written foreseeability into the ordinary course provision. The ordinary course provision talks about the conduct. The what they're calling the material adverse change clause doesn't talk about the conduct whatsoever. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Justice Kiddush, you go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I apologize. My question is as to the AB Stable case. I didn't see it when I read that case, anything about a government order to shut down. Is there something like that in that case?
I'm trying to think of the facts of that case. There was a shutdown of some sort, not a complete government shutdown as in this case. It's different being non-essential businesses. I don't think anybody had that same sort of scenario where the entire industry, the gaming industry, was shut down. But everybody had shutdowns of their own, and that's what they were dealing with. And that you're not, you know, and in that case, they said, well, the ordinary course provision shifts that complete responsibility that anything outside of the ordinary course is going to be borne by the seller. They could have negotiated and tempered that with a typical material adverse effects clause. I don't agree that this is what 15E is. It has the word material adverse damage or change,
yeah,
rather.
That was going to be my question. Yeah. You keep referring to the so-called material adverse effects clause as unusual and atypical and not really a material effects clause. I'd like you to elaborate on that.
Sure. The typical material adverse effects clause would be akin to a force majeure clause or something of that nature, but it would go further. And every single one of the cases that I've read that deal with an adverse material effects clause, you know, they're very case specific because it's exactly whatever the language is in that particular contract. There's no general one.
So is the unusual language the within the seller's control clause, or
it would be something? Yeah, it could be something like that. It could be something. It could state specific types of changes that are, you know, contemplated, depending on the type of business. Maybe it has to do with if it was an agriculture purchase. Maybe it has to do with the weather or something of that nature. The availability of pesticides. Who knows what it is? But it's going to be specific to that business, that contract. I'd say this contract is sort of light on all that for what we're talking about. We're talking about the sale and purchase of a hotel and casino. It's not that elaborate. It doesn't have it. It just has the ordinary course clause requiring the seller to maintain in the ordinary course.
Well, I think their argument is that this material adverse effects clause, let's call it that for the sake of discussion, harmonizes with their reading of the ordinary course clause in that if the cause of the change is outside the seller's control, then that burden is not shifted by this contract.
I don't think it actually says that. I think it's if that were the case, it would say the seller is not obligated to maintain the ordinary course if it was outside their control. It doesn't actually say that. It just says that if there's any financial condition that was changed, but it wasn't you that changed it, that will not be considered. But that's not what is.
I agree with you. They're kind of reading the expression of one thing is the exclusion of another.
Exactly.
Into this interpretation on that.
Exactly. It's an opposite reading of the actual language. And if it were an exclusion, it would be written as an exclusion. But it's not written as an exclusion. There's no exclusion.
But conversely, if you meant them to be responsible for any material adverse change to their financial condition, you would not have had or tolerated the language within the seller's control. So it kind of cuts both ways.
Well, yeah, except that one caught, again, I think we're making an assumption that everything is about money in this case, and it's about the operation. And the ordinary course clause talks about the operation. The word financial doesn't even appear in it. The word operation doesn't appear in what we're calling the material adverse effects clause. They're two different things.
So you would treat this case as dependent entirely on the ordinary course clause and say this, whatever the number is, 1.5E, is extraneous and shouldn't be considered by us.
I would absolutely say that because, number one, we haven't even gone into the financials in the lower record. That's not a defense. Oh, you know, they did produce financials of afterwards, but really what matters is during the escrow period, not what happens afterwards. And again, because the parties contemplated that the operation was going to remain the same, the material adverse effects concerning financials, you could get into a whole, you know, discovery phase about what caused this, what caused that. There's a cause and effect element to whether or not what they did cause of an adverse financial effect. There's no such thing when you get to the ordinary course provision. It's, did you maintain it in the ordinary course or not? I don't care about the financials because it's not mentioned in that clause whatsoever.
Mr. Wright, go ahead, yes. Justice Bell.
So assuming that no one's really at fault here, right? Because we have the governor shut down, gaming control is not allowing people, I mean, certainly to continue to operate a casino during that time, it would have been a violation of 1.5C. Doesn't 1.4B require the earnest money deposit to stay with Lucky Lucy? I mean, it only gets returned if there's a material breach, right?
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're saying absent there being a breach of the clause. No, I think what the court stated is alternatively is, look, even, you know, beyond there being a breach, if this were a situation where this is an issue that was not contemplated by the parties at the time entering into the agreement, it was not foreseeable, and let's say it's not covered by the ordinary course provision, then the object of the contract had basically dissipated. It's the same exactly what they're saying. It's interesting because in the beginning of the case, they said, well, pandemics are foreseeable. This is not an unforeseeable event. But later on, they go, this is an unforeseeable event. We couldn't possibly have kept, you know, known that the governor was going to shut us down. If that's the case, then why wouldn't the parties both be restored to the original positions? It's then you, what you're saying is then that the risk shifted to my client, whereas we have a contractual risk shifting provision here already. That if the if there's an unforeseen circumstance which makes the object of the contract basically void or irrelevant, I'm not sure what the exact word is, but it's no longer viable, then that they should get the earnest money deposit. Why would that be the case? If neither party is at fault, why would one party profit from that? The earnest money is my client's money, okay?
Right, but they're saying there's consideration that passed for that in that they took the property off the market and you enjoyed exclusive rights to purchase during that time, right?
Well, that's what they're saying. However, if in fact the contract were to be, if either party's excused, then, or both parties are excused, then both parties should be returned to their original position because it's not only that side that's expending sums. My client's the one that has to go and audit the books. My client's the one that has to hire the accountants to do the due diligence. So certainly both sides have.
But you're being excused from the obligation to purchase, to pay the full purchase price under that.
Well, I understand, but it's still being punished at the same time. It's not an excuse because if I were excused, then the earnest money would come back. The reason that I'm not being excused, and then they get to keep the earnest money. That's right, no difference in saying I'm walking away from a transaction.
But
period.
The contract that your client entered into says the deposit shall be non-refundable and shall only be returned to the purchaser in the event of a material default of this agreement by seller.
Right. But if there is a breach, number one, which is what the court found, then it comes back to us. If what you're saying is that each party is excused and neither one is being breached, the contract is basically being voided. That's the difference. We're going back to where the parties would be. What they claim is, well, it's a harsh situation if my client gets to keep the earnest money. But wouldn't it be a harsh situation if my client doesn't get to keep the earnest money and doesn't really have the option of the benefit of the bargain at the same time? Benefit of the bargain was, I have an operation that's going to be continuing to operate in the same manner at the day of signing all the way through closing. That's a material element when you're in a merger or acquisition. It's an ongoing concern. All right. It's not like purchasing a car. There's nothing that's going to change in that in the next year. But when you're buying a business, a material element of it, and that's why it's in the contract, is that it's going to be maintained in exactly the same way or roughly the same way as it always has been. You're going to take that element away and still at the same time say they're not in breach. It can't possibly work that way because both sides should be restored to their original positions or at least not be punished because of a circumstance out of both of their control, which is not only contrary to what the contract says, but something that makes performance by either party impossible. For instance, my client not being able to get licensure.
Wasn't that only a temporary impossibility, though, in that 6 weeks later they reopened and began to make money? Couldn't both parties have still closed?
It's possible, but again, not without changing the terms of the contract, or at least waiving a material element to the contract. That would be the case. Of course, nobody could see when it's going to close or whether it's going to reclose. And in fact, we cite to the governor's directive where the governor said, we may be doing this again soon. We just don't know. And so, yeah. And of course, the whole thing about letting go of the workforce is kind of the same thing. After we reopen, nobody understood what that's going to look like. And of course, we have a workforce shortage and you let go of the entire, you know, majority of the workforce. Or how long does it get to start ramping up again? How long does it take to get government agendas back on calendar again? It's a very slow process. Nobody could possibly foresee what it would be. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Okay.
Thank you. And Justice Kadish, I would like to answer a question you posed to Mr. Wright about AV Stable. You asked about the timing of some of the changes that were made to those businesses there. And on page 81 of that case was the reference I made to the Palo Alto Hotel. And it was closed, quote, because there was no demand. That's AV Stable at 81, not because of any governmental order. The same discussion, same page, or maybe a page before on 80, is the discussion about the Four Seasons at Jackson Hole in Teton County, Wyoming, where it was closed, even though Teton County never had a closure order for hotels. They simply shuttered it before any governmental order came down. And even when it came down, they would have been allowed to have had it open. But every one of those 15 hotels were shuttered before any governmental order came down. So that's a massive distinction in AV Stable to the facts at bar. There's some attractiveness, of course, to always saying, well, let's just put the parties back to their beginning. That always crops up in the law, right? It appeals to our desire to put kids back in the corner and, you know, figure out how to start the recess again. The problem is, and that's an argument of equity, and I didn't handle the underlying case in the district court, but I've thoroughly read all the transcripts, and equity kept popping up in the discussion all the time. But this is a contract case where the court held, and I don't disagree, that the contract is firm and unambiguous and clear. And that was argued by Mr. Wright, and it was argued by my predecessor counsel, that this is a clear and unambiguous contract. So these terms of equity and that those notions have just put us back into the position before we met simply are not quite appropriate here. It's also not appropriate because my client, where do I go to get my client's time back? And Justice Pickering, you nailed that question. You said the consideration of earnest money deposit. Everybody knows earnest money deposit is at risk. The contract, Justice Bell, as you said, 1.4, makes clear that it's at risk through the due diligence period, and then only a material breach can shift that back to the buyer. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. This case will stand submitted and will be in recess until the next call of the court. Thanks for your argument.